Welcome to Sparks of History, where Jewish history and world history meet. We are very pleased and honored to have with us today Rabbi Dr. Yossi Ives. Rabbi Ives currently serves as the rabbi of Congregation Avos Yisrael in Pomona, New York, bringing with him over 20 years of rabbinic leadership, mostly in the UK, but also in New York, Sydney, Berlin, and Brussels. In addition to his rabbinic ordination, Rabbi Dr. Ives, Yossi Ives, earned a master's degree in social science and a PhD in coaching psychology. Rabbi Ives founded and is chief executive of TAG International Development, which we will be talking about, a charitable organization that focuses on sharing Israeli expertise with developing countries. Rabbi Ives has authored and co-authored numerous books and articles, including Shidduch Success, Date Well, Applied Jewish Values in Social Sciences and Psychology, Relationship Coaching, The Theory and Practice of Coaching for Singles, Couples, and Parents, Goal-Focused Coaching, Theory and Practice, Seder Hishtalshelut, which is a book on mystical cosmology in Hebrew, and There Must Be a Better Way. And today, we will be discussing Rabbi Ives' fascinating and very timely work, A Light from Zion, Why Israeli Innovation Matters to the World. Rabbi Ives, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Okay. Just to get started, A Light from Zion, what inspired you to write A Light from Zion?
So I'm a person who is steeped in Jewish learning. I was brought up within an intensely Jewish environment, and I feel very enriched by that. I feel that I was blessed to be given access to the riches of our heritage. But as I got older and as I began to recognize that there's a big world out there, it became increasingly unclear to me what is our responsibility, what is our role and function within the broader context of humanity. And increasingly, I came to the view that we have a contribution to make, that we're a unique people with a unique responsibility, and that there are things which if we don't do, nobody else will or can. And that led me to the idea that there is this country called Israel, which has gone through a rapid experience of development from a very, very poor and low start. It raced at breakneck speed to the top of the tree in many areas of human development and became truly an astonishing example of success, not perfect by any means, still much to be done, but highly impressive by almost any parameter. And when one compares Israel to its neighbors or to countries that became independent in the same general time frame, it is hard to find a single country that compares, especially when you consider what Israel had to go through in terms of its security challenges, constantly dealing with quite trenchant adversaries, were doing everything possible to make it difficult for Israel to survive, never mind to flourish. And in all of this, it didn't happen in a vacuum. And I was interested in seeing how to take what Israel had learned and turn it into a resource for other countries that haven't done as well to benefit from what Israel has learned to do. Because it's not a coincidence. Israel's success is the product of a multitude of innovations, of, I would say, quite impressive efforts to not accept the problems, but in fact, to tackle them and to overcome them. The way I put it is like this. Other countries have the same problems Israel had. The only difference is Israel solved them. Israel started out in exactly the same place, very, very poor rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality, very poor economy, with a level of agriculture which was not much different to some of the most struggling countries around the world. It had so many problems, and the only reason why Israel was able to succeed, besides for the clear hand of God, was the fact that the people of Israel were inspired and motivated to find, some cases, truly exceptional, brilliant solutions to those problems. And in many cases, Israel has grown out of those solutions. It no longer needs them. It's now a wealthy country and it can afford to waste money like everybody else does. But there are countries around the world, and I'm talking about the vast majority, in fact, that do not have the luxury of spending vast amounts of money. And they really do need to have creative and cost-effective solutions. And Israel has those in abundance. And my vision is to see Israel at the forefront of global good. I would like to see the Jewish people get a Nobel Prize in 20 years' time for having transformed the world, right? For having lifted up humanity in the same way that we lifted up our own people after the Holocaust, after that unimaginable horror. And we put our energies not into being a victim, but into creating one of the most remarkable miracles in human history, the modern state of Israel. And the book is designed to showcase much of what is most interesting about Israel's accomplishments, mostly focused not on the high-tech subject that everybody likes to talk about, but looking at the many, many other less known ways in which Israel has become a true success story.
And you talk about the seven secrets of Israel's success. What are they? And how did you come to those seven?
Look, Israel is a unique country. The Jewish people is a unique people. I'm not trying to make out as if everybody's going to be able to do a copy and paste from Israel to, let's say, Rwanda, or from Israel to the Central African Republic. I understand that each country has its own unique identity and challenges. But I did ask myself, what were the underlying principles that led Israel to be so successful? Because we can look to the specific solutions, but why is it one country was able to come up with those solutions and able to implement them? And I'll give you my answer as best I can. One, Israel is a knowledge society. Even before, decades before the State of Israel was established, several really high-class universities were brought into existence, whether the Technion in 1912. This was while Israel was Palestine under the Ottoman Empire, whether in 1918, the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, or in 1934, the Weizmann Institute. These are all now world-class academic institutions. They were all set up before, long before, in some cases, the State of Israel. In other words, the underpinnings of the success started by investing in human potential. Israel, as you know, has an extremely high number of PhDs per capita. It publishes the highest number of peer-reviewed scientific papers per capita, and it produces amongst the greatest number of published books per capita of any country on the planet. Israel is investing in every other way in its development of knowledge, whether it's how to deal with youth at risk, how to be effective at rehabilitation, how to be world-class in environmental protection, and so on. So we have to start off with the fact that we are called the people of the book for a reason. And we lived by that, and we are benefiting from that. The second is something that is not spoken about enough, and that is the all people matter. It is something which really makes Israel unique, considering the countries around the world. Start off with the fact that women are always valued and given opportunity, including at the highest levels, whether that's as prime minister, heads of major universities, large corporations, government ministries, and even recently as fighter pilots. And the examples are legion. Israel has a long way to go still, but has a stellar record when it comes to special needs, incorporating people with all kinds of disabilities, finding ways to rehabilitate people who've experienced injuries through war, terrorism, and other natural causes. Israel has an extremely high level of volunteering by comparison to most countries. And for a child with learning difficulties, Israel is perhaps the best place in the world to have been born, with truly unique expertise in how to take every child and allow them to develop their own capacity. I'll give a couple more brief examples. Immigrants, migrants. Israel took in vast numbers of migrants and didn't just let them in the country, but invested in them, helping them to be acculturated, to be developed in all different ways, and also minorities. This is a sore point, but we need to be honest. All minorities in Israel have full democratic rights. Arab doctors and dentists and nurses are fully integrated into the medical system in a remarkable success. You have Arabs serving as parliamentarians, high court judges, and so on. Israel is successful because everybody is part of the program. Number three, social solidarity. Israel was built on an idea that everyone got behind. Now that Israel's been more prosperous, perhaps this idea has waned. But people in the 19, let's say 50s or 40s or 30s or even 1970s and 80s, highly idealistic. People got together in kibbutzim and moshavim. People welcomed migrants, sacrificed so they could so extraordinarily high taxes for migrants to be able to get education and healthcare in a way that there's no country that compares. And the Jewish people have also been part of this success, and we are also contributing, whether that's buying Israel bonds or visiting Israel or investing in each in our own way, showing that we are part of the Israel story. Number four is building capacities. Again, this is not spoken about enough, but people who go to Israel will take for granted that there are excellent roads and transport services and energy systems and water supply. You know how many countries, even like South Africa, have regular blackouts, have energy rationing, or have water issues, even in America? It's unheard of in Israel. It's incredible that one of the driest countries on the planet, there is no shortage of water. And good quality water. It's incredible that Israel has a very successful internal revenue system. Nobody wants to pay taxes, but you cannot run a modern country without it. And you look at most countries and people don't pay taxes. And in Israel, this is part of the capacity of the state to have well-run government. Not perfect, but definitely impressive if you think where Israel started off. Number five is something people know about, which is Israel's flexibility and creativity. Israelis have been excellent at identifying and exploiting opportunities. They're very good at adapting quickly to changing circumstances. I'll give you an example. It became clear at one point that growing peppers was no longer going to be the cash cow, right? So they would switch to a new crop. Or when growing Jaffa oranges turned out no longer to be as profitable because others had gotten on the trick and could do it even more cheaply, so they switched to the peppers. They were able to quickly identify where there was a new opportunity, and they could, within a matter of months, retool for the new challenge ahead. Israel managed to solve many of its problems very inexpensively. I'll give you just an example. Magen David Adom, Israel's ambulance service, runs on about 1,200 paid staff and 14,000 volunteers. And if you go to one of their stations, as I have been, let's say, in Nahariya, and you walk in the station, you'll see people coming in and out of rooms. You will have no idea who is a paid person and who is a, who's a volunteer. They are as professional, as proficient, as motivated, as dedicated. If you call an ambulance in Israel and someone shows up at the door, that paramedic may be paid, may be a volunteer. You'll have no way of knowing unless you ask them. It's incredible that 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds in Israel, in the thousands, volunteer on ambulances are learning to deal with life-threatening emergencies at a time when their American peers are still basically binging on television reruns. Okay? It's incredible that we are incorporating people into the provision of the success of the country. You look at how Israel was able to flourish under such water-starved conditions by using creativity to get water from place A to place B, drilling it water in ways that were thought impossible and never been done before. It's a long list of incredible accomplishments to come up with solutions that costed very little and achieved great results. I'll give you two more quick examples. There's an organization called Perach, where they use imperfect food, which would otherwise not be sellable in the supermarket, to feed poor families. The cost of distributing that is tiny by comparison to the amount it's worth to the people who eat it, who don't care that the banana is not entirely the typical shape, or there's a slight blemish on the apple. It's an incredible project, saving the country hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Sorry, that organization is called Leket. I apologize. Perach is a different organization. It's also incredibly brilliant, extremely cost-effective, that for a reduction in student tuition at university level, students volunteer to help children at risk. They create a situation which is the most cost-effective way of helping children at risk ever devised by humanity, where for a reduction in their student tuition fees, they volunteer twice a week to help out a kid who needs help, who needs an older brother or an older sister. The saving to the country is again in the hundreds of millions, and the cost is tiny because it's a relatively small sacrifice. If they had to hire people and pay them to do this, it would cost them 10 times as much. Number six is periphery and frontiers. You look at many countries, including the country I come from, Britain, and look at America, and how much of the concentration is in the big cities, and there they flourish, and there there's wealth, sometimes unbelievable wealth, and the rest of the country is a backwater, not Israel. From day one, Israel identified its frontiers, the border communities, the places in the Negev, the places up north, and made them a central part of Israel's development success. There are development towns, industrial zones, regional technology parks. There's very strong transportation. We complain about it, but you can go anywhere from Tahrir el-Merkazit in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv to any part of the country relatively easily and quickly. This isn't a country that grew successful because of two or three major urban conurbations, but because a whole country was part of its success story. And finally, and this is something we don't need to go on about because everyone understands, is Israel's innovation and entrepreneurship. Israel's investment in R&D is unparalleled. Its support of its startups is legendary. The government and the private sector work together to take the risks to create the opportunities of the future. And we now have a situation where a very substantial number of the most innovative and most impactful technologies that have changed our lives in the past 30, 40 years came out of Israel. Who could possibly have expected that? When you think about the competition, all those big European countries and other countries that have economies and populations vastly superior to Israel, and Israel seemed to outpunch them and seemed to come ahead when it came to innovation and entrepreneurship.
Wonderful, thank you. Let's just maybe take a few examples that are brought in the book, A Life from Zion, that will solidify what you've said, Rabbi Ives, and then bring it back to the whole idea of being light into the nations. The Bible, the Torah, tells us that Israel is a land of milk and honey. And people say, what does that mean? Like, what is that a metaphor for something else? Is it literal? How do you understand Israel today being a land of milk and honey.
A second, you're jumping around. Okay. Both milk and honey are seen as denoting abundance, a place where it's not only possible to survive, but to flourish, to live well, to have the good life. And I think one of the most remarkable things about Israel and why it is a place of such hope to the world is because Israel didn't just survive, which itself, Dayenu, is a pretty impressive accomplishment. But it went on to be highly prosperous, a country with, again, it has its struggles, but a country where most people have real opportunity, and a country that offers each generation a better prospect, a quality of life, a standard of living that is really amongst the best in the world. Israelis are, in fact, rated often as among the top countries for quality of life, for the happiness index, and so on. And as somebody who's worked internationally and met people from the furthest corners of the planet, I can tell you that people look to Israel in awe, and they are inspired by Israel. And they see Israel as the best example of what they could achieve or what is possible. Nobody is naive that this was handed to Israel on a platter. This was something that had to be worked on for years and shows you what's possible. And so when we talk about milk and honey, we're talking about the way that Israel has become a wonderful place to live. But quite literally, do you know that Israeli cows, the same exact cows, the ones you see on the bottles of milk, the black and white Friesian cows, that an Israeli cow produces four times as much milk as the exact same cow in Ethiopia. Four times. It's 400% more milk. The same exact breed. How is it possible? It turns out Israeli cows are happy cows. They've learned how to make cows in Israel stress-free. They make sure they're ventilated and that their needs are met. It's incredible. And as a result of knowing how to treat cows the best, they have been able to produce cows that produce the highest milk production of any cow on this planet. And so literally, it is a land of milk. It is also a land of honey. Israel has an incredibly advanced beekeeping sector. It's called apiculture. And I happen to know a bit about this because my organization ran a beekeeping project in Myanmar for 7.5 years based on Israeli expertise. And we actually brought 83 Israeli queen bees to Myanmar to begin to modernize the beekeeping sector in that country. Myanmar is also Burma, for those who don't know, Southeast Asia, near China and Thailand. And Israel has an exceptionally successful beekeeping sector. And for people who don't know, bees are extremely important for agriculture. If we didn't have bees, we would have no food because they pollinate key crops that we need to survive. And so, quite literally, Israel is a great success story, both in milk and in honey.
Fascinating. Israelis love to hike. Israelis love nature, and certainly Israel is known for its tree planting, JNF. How is modern Israel today a role model for the preservation of nature?
What's so incredible about this is that Israel, from the beginning, has been in a battle for survival. It, from day one, was invaded by five armies determined to crush it, snuff it out before it even got to breathe its first breath, and has had to face persistent and aggressive attempts at undermining it pretty much its entire existence. Who would think that anybody in Israel has time to worry about the ecology and the environment when you had to take in millions of refugees and fight multiple wars and deal with massive boycotts and so on? So it's just worth stopping for a second just to appreciate that when you go to Israel and you have all these amazing national parks and wonderful environmental protected areas, this is truly astonishing. There is nothing else like it on the planet. And that is because the Israeli leaders and Israeli public understood and accepted that for their long-term good, Israel needed to protect its environment. And it is that that has allowed Israel to be so unbelievably successful. I'll give you just a few examples. Israel's water conservation. In the Negev Desert, you end up with these deluges. Certain times in the year, you end up with this outpouring of water. Because the earth is so dry, the water runs off and goes to the sea, and it's lost. Not in Israel. That water is collected. That water is conserved. It's allowing the whole of the Negev to blossom. It allowed you to have vibrant communities in places where there is no water because Israel is extremely good at conserving its water. Israel famously is the world Olympic leader in reforestation. We don't understand how, even just a few hundred years ago, maybe even a few decades ago, you could be, let's say, 150 years ago in the land of Israel, and you could tell someone to meet me by the tree. And everyone understood what that was because it was one tree without no other tree for miles. A tree was a true landmark, right? Now, Israel has planted millions upon millions of trees. And Israel is by far the world leader in reforestation, in bringing back forests, forests that didn't exist for thousands of years even. And Israel has now created a lush land. It's incredible. The desertification. Most of the world is experiencing an expansion of desert. The desert is taking over more and more land. Israel was one of the only countries in the world where the desert has got smaller and that land has been brought back to life. Israel has got bird migrations. Millions of birds fly over Israel every year. And it's incredible that this country that's got so many other things on its head is creating a way for these birds to stop in Israel and get refueling and allow them to eat. Well, they need to continue on their migration without destroying the crops that people need to be able to feed their families. It's an insane operation that, again, only in Israel type of thing. I'll give you one more, only in Israel. Israel has reintroduced multiple native species, animals that you've never heard of, rare, like a species which existed in Israel hundreds of years ago and have long been extinct, have now been reintroduced into Israel. Who even has time to think about this stuff? And yet Israel is doing this and is doing this extremely well. And that's how Israel has really come to be a banner to the world in how your technological development and your economic development can still be, and in fact needs to be, combined with environmental development.
You had mentioned before, Rabbi Ives, the dealing with disabilities and rehabilitation. How is Israel leading the way worldwide in dealing with all kinds of disabilities?
It goes back, as we said earlier, to the fact that intrinsic in Israel's value system is this idea that you cannot be successful if only some part of the population is successful, if only one gender gets ahead, or only one ethnicity gets ahead, or only one demographic group gets ahead. And so Israel has put a tremendous amount of investment into finding ways to ensure that people, even people who are severely disabled, have the maximum opportunity. And it truly is awe-inspiring. There's an organization called Beit Izi Shapira. I've worked with them, I've visited them many times. Really world-class what they have been able to do, pushing the boundaries on almost every front. For example, creating playgrounds that are both suitable for able-bodied and disabled children. It's so incredible the thought that went into coming up with these playgrounds that can work well for both, and to see the pictures of children with and without disabilities playing together. It's something which you would have thought was practically impossible, and yet they have achieved that. Or, for example, coming up with the most ingenious ways of using tablets so that children who can't speak, and autistic children, or people who just are limited in their speech for other reasons, should be able to communicate using technology in exactly the best way possible. I would urge people to go and see for themselves. It's almost impossible to imagine what they've been able to do, being a world pioneer, for example, in hydrotherapy, in using swimming pools as a form of therapy for people with disabilities, and so on and so forth. World leader in all of these areas, teaching the world in all of these areas. People are coming to Israel to see how Israel does it. Because you understand that Israel's not the only country with disabled adults and disabled children. The difference is that Israel's one of the only countries that's figuring it out. And now others taking Israel's example. There's an organization called Yad Sarah, another organization I've met many times, truly exceptional. They came up with a simple idea that when you're not a wealthy country, as Israel was in the 1980s when this was first introduced, when Israel was on the verge of bankruptcy, even at that point, that it was not possible for people to be able to afford a wheelchair or crutches or other types of devices. And so they created a system for people to be able to essentially borrow it for as long as they need it, return it. They would rehabilitate it and recirculate it. And this has saved the country each year hundreds of millions of dollars, mostly paid by volunteers. And now, there is nobody in Israel who cannot, within a very short time, find the equipment they need to be able to get themselves quite literally back on their feet. Do you know that the IDF is the only army in the world known, of course, for its ruthlessness, for its extreme professionalism, for its high levels of technical ability, is still the only army in the world that has a unit made up entirely of autistic people. You wouldn't even believe it was possible. But they've discovered that people with autism have a special gift for being able to patiently observe certain visual patterns. And they created a unit, and these people are now observing the skies around Israel for any kind of suspicious objects, keeping Israel safe, right? Not despite their disability, but because of it. And it's just inspiring. And I heard about a mother talking about her son. And just what it's done for him, for his self-esteem, for his ability to feel normal and feel part of his own country, because he was given not just any role, but this is an elite role. This is a technically advanced role. It's amazing. I'll just end on a personal note. I have a child with a disability. And at one point, I was seriously going to move to Israel. And one of the reasons why I was thinking of doing so is because this is a rare disability, only one in 15,000 people. To give you an idea, Down syndrome is one in 700. This is one in 15,000. It's very rare. And the only country on the planet that has proper homes for people with this particular condition is Israel. And not only do they have one, they have two, for religious and for the not religious, so that everybody would have a place they feel comfortable. And it's just unbelievable that somebody would care enough to set up a special organization for a specific disability to ensure that they have a quality of life. You can't do that unless you love your people.
How is it that we hear when there's an earthquake in Haiti and a famine somewhere else in Africa or another natural disaster that's happening around the world? Why is it that you hear that Israeli teams are sent to these places? How did that happen?
So there are two reasons. One reason I think people know about, the other people don't. I'll start with the one that people don't know, understand. Israel is one of the only countries on the planet where disaster preparedness isn't something you have a special department for. It's wired into the system. After Hurricane Katrina, I was sitting in a meeting with the American Red Cross, and I was the sort of bringing my Israeli colleagues, and we were having a conversation about this, trying to strengthen the collaboration. And all of these top leaders at the American Red Cross said, we should be more like Israel. Came this hurricane, nobody knew what to do. They had all the equipment, nobody knew where it was, nobody knew how to use it. They didn't even have the keys for the locks for the sheds. Nobody was prepared because everybody had all this expensive equipment, but when it comes, when the disaster comes, you don't know where it's going to come, you don't know when it's going to come, how it's going to come. Israel doesn't work like that. Israel's disaster preparedness is called life. It's built in to everyday existence. An example would be there's an organization called Matav, and they provide home care for elderly. So they'll have a nurse come, like we have in many countries, come and help them with their daily needs. But these same people are also the first responders to an emergency. If there was an earthquake, they would know where all of their people are, and they're part of the emergency response, not some FEMA, which has been a controversial thing because it's been a failure. Donald Trump has just said, maybe we should just get rid of it. It's not fit for purpose because you have a disaster organization that's not connected to reality. Israel wires its disaster preparedness into its ordinary organizations. So, for example, the same organization that would come and bandage your knee if you fell down the stairs in your home is the same organization which would respond if there was a national crisis. That's the only country that has got this quite as well integrated. And I personally was part of a thrill of my life where I was allowed to participate in a national drill. Every year there is a national drill in Israel. Most people wouldn't know about this. I was part of it, and it was insane. They get all of the emergency services to simulate what would happen if there was a genuinely serious crisis. That year, the simulation was a Boeing 747 crashing into Ben Gurion Airport. And I have to tell you, the adrenaline rush, I was on an ambulance together with Magen David Adom, and you had the fire, the police, the army, the airport authorities, everybody, intelligence services, everybody was going to participate in this simulation. They even literally blew up a 747. It was on fire. They literally had quote unquote dead bodies strewn everywhere. And I watched what was going on. And it is just incredible level of preparedness, right? This is not something that they have happening in some emergency department. It is the normal police, the normal ambulance, the normal airport authority that's supposed to be handling your baggage are part of Israel's emergency response, which is why, in a case of emergency, Israel is so much better prepared to react to a crisis. That's what people don't know. The thing that people do know is Israel is very good at being agile and flexible. And I already addressed this a bit earlier, so I will not repeat myself. But the speed with which Israel, for example, can put a field hospital up, it's like Israel's hospital is in operation before other people are even trying to work at where their hospital is stored. It is literally insane. They had whole planes with fully equipped hospitals arriving in, let's say, Haiti, when other agencies from other countries are literally having meetings to figure out what would be the best way to respond. And that's something which has allowed Israel to be so versatile in addressing both its threats and also, obviously, its opportunities.
Ramesh, tell us a little bit about TAG, International Development, why you set it up, what are its goals, and how you see that as part of the Jewish idea of being a light unto the nations, tying it into Jewish history.
I believe that the Jewish people has two challenges. One is for us to preserve our identity, for us to live out our destiny, to grow amazing families, fantastic communities, and in the case of Israel, to develop a country that is going to be a great success. But I do believe that we have a secondary role, and that is for us to be agents for good in the world, for us to be part of the Almighty's answer to human need. The fact is that there are 9 billion plus people on the planet today. At least half of those, that's many billions of people living with levels of poverty and dysfunction that are unimaginable to someone living in a Western country. People without running water, without proper education, without any decent health care, with enormous levels of instability. And it's not our fault. I'm not saying we're to blame because there are places where things are not so good. But even if I'm not to blame, I can still make a difference. There's a Talmudic concept of Zeh Neheneh v'zeh lo yechaser. If I can benefit you at no loss to myself, why on earth would I not want to do that? If I know how to save a baby's life and I can share that knowledge and save somebody else's baby, in which way am I losing out? Why would I not want to do that? And I think we should accept that we have now a unique opportunity. I understand that decades ago, we were rebuilding ourselves after the Holocaust, and we have done a remarkable job, put the Jewish community, the Jewish people back on its feet. We have created amazing Holocaust memorials, museums, and that we have been able to become a worthy, I think, continuation of our forebears. All the communities, yeshivas, whatever it may be that we have established. We also put our efforts into creating a Jewish country, and we have done a remarkable job. And it was right that that was our priority. Now that we have successfully accomplished those goals, I think it's important for us to embrace our role as part of, I would say, a central part of the solution to the global issue, which is very, very high levels of human dysfunction, suffering, and loss of opportunity. And it happens to be that we do have a lot to offer. And I would say it's in two categories. One, Jewish values. It's amazing how few people realize that Jewish values is not to be taken for granted. We have ideas and principles that others do not, that we think are unquestioned because we've only ever known that's how it is. But it's not true. Concepts like hospitality, so many values about how we approach the aged, how we approach imbuing values in children. There's a long list of ways in which the Jewish people have learned to do things over thousands of years because of our great teachers and our Masorah, the Torah that we have, and that is something which is ours, but there are things we can share with others. And I think we should share our values with the world. The world is ready to hear what the Jewish people have to say about what it is to get things right. I think we should be proud of ourselves that we've been able to accomplish so much, but we can also recognize that with that comes an opportunity to share with others. And the second is Israeli expertise. Here's a country where wherever you turn, somebody has come up with some kind of recycling initiative, some kind of volunteering scheme, some kind of economic regeneration program. Like wherever you go, there's somebody who's come up with some incredible idea how to make the world a better place. Why do we need to limit it to the boundaries of the state of Israel? There's a whole world out there. And I want to say this, we get very upset, rightly so, that the world talks badly about the Jewish people and talks badly about Israel. I want to say two things. Number one, it is not true that the whole world doesn't like us. It happens to be that some of the most noisy, opinionated people who have nothing better than to do than to mouth off seem to think that we make an easy target. But let me tell you, for every person who's got something negative to say, there are two people who think we are amazing and would love to be our friends and are desperate for us to reach out and say we want to work with you. I have been to countries like Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Rwanda, all over the world. And when people hear that you're associated with Israel, they want to be closer to you. They want to know how they can have a piece of that pie. What is it that you can offer? And we should not be too caught up in the fact that there are people who think that it's their job to put us down. And we should also recognize that there's only so much use in us defending ourselves, focusing on the things our enemies want us to focus on, whether or not Israel's right to bomb a particular building in Gaza. What about the fact that there are billions of people suffering right now in ways that are unimaginable to us? What would you rather we spoke about? Whether or not Israel's right or wrong to close down UNRWA, or would you rather we spoke about our program to help billions of people to lead a better life? I think it's completely unfair to all those people who need Israel and could benefit from the Jewish people. We should not be distracted. We have an opportunity to be at the forefront of global good, and I think we should take that opportunity.
And so TAG, the organization that you founded and direct, just some examples of what you're doing and where you see a TAG in the future.
So the ideal that drove it is this idea that there's this country with this unique knowledge and we want to share it. In practice, what happened was for about 15 years, I was doing projects on the ground. We did women's health projects in Indonesia. We did youth development projects in Kenya. We did agricultural projects in Sri Lanka and in Myanmar. And all over the world, we did emergency medicine in Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Ukraine, all sorts of initiatives, as much as possible using Israeli experts and in partnership with Israeli organizations. Now that is less of what I do because, as you can tell, I'm not as young as I used to be, and globetrotting is kind of not my thing anymore. Plus, what has happened in the past 15 years at many, many new organizations, I'm talking about now a couple of dozen, have arisen. And what I'm doing is no longer as innovative as it was then, when almost nobody was operating in this way. So now my goal is more towards sharing the message, which is why I wrote the book. I'm actually now developing a partnership with the Jerusalem municipality to create a program that will teach groups from all over the world, diplomats, politicians, academics, Jewish youth, Israeli leaders to be more familiar with Jewish values and what Israel can offer the world, and all set within the context of our heritage. And I'm hoping that we're going to be able to inspire millions of people to think literally about the words of the Navi, Ki Mitzion Tetzer, that literally people will come for knowledge to Jerusalem.
Have Jewish organizations in North America worked with you on these? Is this mission and this idea, does that resonate with them as a part of Tikkun Olam, of rectifying things in the world and being a light into the nations?
Okay, so there are, I've got to be careful how I answer this question, but there are different ethos here. Most of the work that is done in this general direction, what's called global issues, are done by people who don't have the same attitude towards Jewish tradition that I do. I'm an Orthodox rabbi, and I am very much looking to do this within the context of a strong connection to Israel, not apologizing for Israel's existence, not trying to criticize it at every turn, and also to do so within the context of the Jewish people as a distinct people. And those values are not necessarily shared by many of the advocates of Tikkun Olam, which is why I don't even use that term.
So if I understand correctly, Rabbi, what you're really saying is that the light unto the nations, the tradition, the heritage, the spirituality, and then, of course, all the innovations, and it goes hand in hand. You cannot separate them. Is that correct?
My passion for global activity, my passion for humanitarianism is not a replacement of my Judaism. It is inspired by it, and I believe that it is part of it. And so I think what we need to see, and I would love to see this happen, and I don't criticize anybody, but I'd like to see there being a greater acceptance amongst traditional Jews that this is not something alien to our heritage. It's central to our Judaism. Every page of the Gemara, every page of the Chumash, you will see this is woven in to our own identity. It's just that we have taken our eye off the ball and we're not giving it attention. I'll just give you one easy example. When Avraham Avinu is given his big mandate, he's going to go and he's going to become the father of a nation. He's going to now go from being an obscure person no one's ever heard of, and he's now going to make his mark. What is he told? He's told that all the families of the earth will find blessing in you, right? What's that to do with it? He was being told that he's going to have his own child, he's going to have his own family, and one day his own nation. Why are we talking about all the families of the earth? It was always from day one clear that we were going to fulfill our destiny when the whole world sees the Jewish people as a blessing and we're a blessing to them. And this is not some twisting of the words. It's literally the foundation block, right? In fact, everyone knows that Avraham, I'm speaking about him not because it's a good example, because he's the founder of our people. Okay? His name was changed from Avraham to Avraham. Why? He was changed because he was about to have a child and start a family. But why was he called Avraham? The Torah says, Ki av hamoin goyim nesaticha, means I'm going to make you the father of a multitude of nations. He was being told he's going to be the father of his own nation. Why is he bringing a multitude of nations? This is, after all, how Abraham became Abraham. It's not a small thing. It was because there was a multitude of nations, and you're going to be the father of those nations. We, the Jewish people, are supposed to be an influence and have a positive impact on a multitude of nations. This is not something you have to dig out of some obscure medrash. This is central to our values. I doubt you want to have a lecture now for an hour on all of the ways that you'll see this throughout the Torah and throughout the Gemara, but this is absolutely central to our people. I understand there were times when it wasn't realistic to talk about it. Jews were persecuted. The Jew in the shtetl, in the Pale of Settlement, talking about having an impact on the world seemed ludicrous. We were barely able to eke together a living. But now that we are in a position where we can have an impact, we need to re-embrace it and recognize it was always our mandate. It was ours. It was taken away from us by persecution. And now we're going to reclaim it as our proper place in the world.
In conclusion, what practical steps do you think individuals, just the regular person who's not involved in international business and the like, can take to implement the principles from a light from Zion in their daily lives? What can we do as individuals?
Well, I'm going to keep it really simple because I do accept that just like I don't think everybody can devote themselves to educating our youth, even though that is of enormous importance. And I don't think that everybody is going to be able to care for our elderly, even though that is of enormous importance. I don't think everybody is going to run a humanitarian organization. But there are two things. One, we can be more informed. It is embarrassing how little we understand about what makes Israel unique, what makes the Jewish people unique, and allows us to have a more, I would say, comprehensive and a more holistic and a more authentic appreciation. I don't begrudge anybody who raves about their favorite falafel stand in Ben Yehuda, but surely that is not the totality of what makes Israel great. And most of the things people are not aware of. For example, how many people know that Israel is the world leader in live altruistic kidney donations? There are more altruistic live kidney donations in Israel than there are in America, India, and China combined. Now you do the math on the population difference. How could it be? Right? And do you know that the percentage of altruistic live kidney donations in Israel 20 years ago was zero? And it now has more than the US, China, and India. That's half the world's population right there. And Israel has more than all of them combined in a year. That is astonishing. How did Israel get to be that successful at that? Nobody knows because no one even is aware of just how incredible an accomplishment to have gone from zero to the world leader by far. Because somebody, his name was Rabbi Yeshaya Heber, came up with the idea of an organization called Matnat Chaim and persuaded people that this is something they could do to change their life. And it went from zero to world leader in a decade. Astonishing accomplishment. Do people know that although Israel never invented the idea of medical clowning, it was actually invented in New York? But Israel took the idea of medical clowning, the idea of bringing entertainers into hospitals to help adults and children, especially children, find it easier to deal with the traumas that they have to go through in hospitals. Israel took this idea and turned it into something extraordinary. Israel is the only country on the planet where you can get a master's degree in medical clowning, where they took this to an art form nobody has ever thought to do. And Israel went from 30 years ago, no one had heard of it, to now world leader in medical clowning. Something people may find funny, but the world capital of schnitzel eating is also the vegan capital of the world. This is just extraordinary that a country like Israel would get to be the vegan capital of the world. I'm not even trying to promote veganism, but it's just remarkable that Israel got to this stage. It's a unique spirit of a people that go for ideas and take it all the way and break every record and turn it into something completely new and impressive. So these are just examples. Why is it that we're not more familiar with these things? I could go on for hours with all these amazing examples. This is what the book is for. I would love people to go to Israel and say, I want to find out about this. I want to learn more about this. How can I go visit some of these organizations that I mentioned and go see what it's like to go to the incredible nerve center, Magen David Adom, for example? It's literally like going to a NASA station. Just walking in there, it blows the mind how they operate. And just become proud and inspired, and then go and inspire others. And then it's the second thing. I'm not saying everybody has to advocate for Israel, but a lot of people do. But they're doing it by sending like silly messages on TikTok. No disrespect to TikTok or to people sending silly messages. But really, we don't like it when the Jewish people are maligned. We don't like it when Israel is unfairly criticized. But what are we doing to make a compelling case for Israel? I think it's time for us to change the tone, to change the language, and I would say change the subject. The subject is not, you think we did this, we think we didn't. It's, do you understand that Israel has the ability to transform the world, and you're busy making an argument because you think a certain checkpoint shouldn't be there? You may be right, you may be wrong. Neither of us know. What we do know is this, that there are billions of people right now whose lives could be improved and even saved through Israeli know-how. Does that not matter? Do you think the kid in East Timor is bothered because Israel criticized for having demolished a building? They are looking for a better life, and Israel has what to offer. And I think we need to speak up. We can't speak up if we are uninformed, which brings me to my first point, which is why I wrote a book, in order to give people, in a fun and interesting way, it's not a very heavy tome, it's not designed to be complicated, it's a very easy read, and it tells all these stories. And when people see what Israel has accomplished, I hope they will be able to stand up and say to people, you don't know the country you're criticizing. You don't know the people you're condemning. If you had even a clue, you would be awe-inspired and you would want more of Israel on the world stage, not to see it pushed to the sidelines, because Israel has more to offer those very people who are most in need than any other country on the planet. And it's time we said it clearly and unashamedly.
Rabbi Ives, thank you so much for your insights and for all of your work. We urge all of our listeners and viewers to go online, A Light from Zion, Why Israeli Innovation Matters to the World. Just go on to Amazon. It's an easy purchase, click of the button. And Rabbi Ives, you should continue to go from strength to strength, from chayil to chayil in all of your endeavors. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.